Hi, my name is Holly. I'm a communications major here at Queens. Describe your vision of the culture you're establishing in higher education.
Oh, I'll take that one. I'll go first. Okay. And it kind of leads to your question about our predecessors and whether we were more open. And so I love the verse in Esther that is about a time, you know, for such a time as this. And I think it's, you never come into trying to fill someone else's shoes. I hate that. I don't know how many people ask me, oh, you've got big shoes to fill. I didn't come to the work, either at my former presidency or any other job I ever took, to think about the shoes that you fill. You come for the next set of great scope of work, the things that are going forward. You have to be kind of a windshield type of leader and not necessarily look in the rear view. So for me, it was, where are we now in Charlotte? What's the work that Central Piedmont needs to do in the scope of work that we're being called to do on behalf of our community, which when I arrived in January of 17 was big. The report, the task force report, was released just a few weeks later. And I don't think, I see some great friends sitting in the audience. I mean, rolling up your sleeves and getting in the midst of that work was really important for the college. And why? I believe that we are a huge centerpiece, an economic piece, engine to that work, and we can do better. And we've admitted that. We've gone out and done some major looking at ourselves in terms of who knows about us, who knows our programs. And so back to the young lady's question, by the way, love that she's a communications major, just saying, that was my starting ground. Not that we're not being recorded. But, you know, ours is about, so this is a different scope of work than what we did 3 years ago, 3 minutes ago, 5 years ago. And so this is about not change management. There's a difference between change management and change leadership. And having that conversation in our college family about how do we lead this change of what we need to do differently, to be very focused on students and their success, to looking at the data about which of our students are being successful, what are the equity gaps of that, what are the skills gaps in that, and how do we really be very honest and frank, and then change our systems inside of our institution as we collectively as a community try to change our systems so that we can take down some of the barriers so that all people have all the opportunities that everyone deserves. And that is hard work. And that's what we're working on.
Anyone else?
Well, okay. I guess there have only been five leaders at UNC Charlotte since it was Charlotte College,
right?
1949, Bonnie Cohn, Dean Colvert, E.K. Fretwell, Jim Woodward, and now I'm ending my time. Every one of us had the same goal, to make it possible for a young student or even an older student to get the most out of their education that they can, and for us to create the conditions for them to be successful. And to do it, go back to your original question, at a price they can afford. That's always a challenge, but I think when you stand up next to me at commencement and you watch these students cross the stage, you know they think it's worth it.
That's cool. I think you're probably the one she really wants to hear from, but I'm going to answer the question anyway. So Davidson's has an abiding primary purpose, and it is to assist students in developing humane instincts and disciplined and creative minds for lives of leadership and service. It is a place where loyalty to all humanity is an imperative of faith, and where the idea that education and citizenship go together, and that free inquiry is an imperative of faith. So what I think that means right now is we have to build a genuinely inclusive environment where we are genuinely welcoming to all the students that come to our campus, that is also a place of joyful discovery and empowerment for them.
Okay, let's go over here.
Hi, my name is Ashley White, and I'm a senior here at Queens studying business management and minoring in Spanish. Something that I'm really passionate about is representation and leadership, especially when it comes to minorities, needing to see ourselves in roles instead of feeling boxed in. And during my undergraduate experience here, I'll be graduating in December, and I have not had a Black professor or a professor who I felt like represented my identity. So my question to you is, what are your universities doing, or what have they done to ensure that minorities have the representation that we need in faculty and administration?
Wow. I think that's an important question.
Yeah. Dr. Lugo, it's your school.
It is. So we have all collectively in higher education focused quite a bit on diversity of the student bodies. And many, not enough, progress has been made, but many have made significant progress as you've looked over the past decades. Here, you may know that a third of our students are domestic students of color, where about 8% of our students are international. So there's incredible diversity here. What hasn't actually been as successful across the nation, as well as here at Queens, is diversifying our faculty and staff. And I think that that is a multi-pronged challenge. It's not just a Queens issue, it is a pipeline issue. It starts with how do we encourage brilliant folks like you to be excited about the academy, right? And how do we mentor folks like you to also consider going on to graduate and PhD work and to find a real depth of passion that will allow us to populate our campuses with increasing diversity at the faculty level. So that's a full, broad challenge that maybe we can think collaboratively on. But I would say that there's been so much overwhelming focus on student representation that we've kind of taken our eye off of the ball on how important it is to have a diverse representation in our faculty.
Yeah, and if I could just weigh in on that, as Charlotte's only HBCU, I think we have a special obligation. One of the focal points of our institution is research. Our QEP is about research, and we are trying to prepare the next generation of leaders in terms of research who may want to go on and take on those responsibilities in the academy. I, like you, had exactly the same experience. In 4 years of undergraduate school, 3 years of law school, I had one professor who was African-American. And that one professor was one that I took in my last year, my last semester of law school, because I felt I could not graduate without at least taking one. And plus, she taught writing, and I needed to improve my writing. So, and she was very, very good. But it is imperative. And you know, people ask about the relevancy of HBCUs and things like that. If there is any reason, we graduate a disproportionate amount of engineers, professionals, I would think probably college professors. I won't state that as a fact. But that is one of the reasons, because we can nurture those young minds and get them passionate about research and maybe going on the academy. That is one of the proudest things that I see at Johnson C. Smith. We have a McNair Scholars Program in which we're preparing these young students who tell me, what do you want to do? I want to be a professor in psychology. I want to be a scientist. I want to have a bench. You know, so those are the things that excite me. So I'm sorry that you've had, unfortunately, a very similar experience that I did, but it will not hold you back, I'm sure.
Okay. Once again, over here.
Hey, I attended Appalachian State University, graduated in 2015, but I would like to ask about the dynamic between college academics and college sports in terms of cost. It was 6 years ago when the Knight Commission published a report, the Charlotte Observer wrote about it in 2013, about the amount of money spent per athlete versus per student. Now, I come from Appalachian State, which is, as most of us know, if we watch college football, is a football powerhouse. And the perception amongst...
So is UNC Charlotte.
Yeah. Well, still to be determined on that front, but the perception, and this could be a misperception, but the perception amongst my colleagues was that we saw a concentrated amount of resources towards a small population within athletics, while the rest of us struggled to get by paying for very basic things like supplies for school. And so what is that dynamic between athletics and education?
I think that one was aimed at me. and we'll get you one day. It depends largely on where you happen to live. When I was president of the University of Wyoming, we could spend state appropriations on our athletic programs, and there was always that direct trade-off between athletics or academics. That's not the case in North Carolina with the public institutions. You cannot spend state dollars on athletics. Now, with that said, student fees do fund a good bit of athletics, particularly at institutions like mine, which don't have a large private fundraising base. But that's oftentimes students are directly engaged in that decision-making process because they happen to want athletic programs as well as a form of student entertainment. So it's not quite the trade-off that maybe the perception would lead you to believe, but there are occasionally trade-offs. With the case of student athletes coming to UNC Charlotte, yes, they're going to get scholarships funded privately. They aren't funded by the student fees, and that does allow student athletes to be able to dedicate their full time to their sport.
Yeah, I would. Can I? I just think it's a very. I would step back and ask the question, you know, and I ask myself this question: why at Davidson College do we play, a school of 2,000 students, do we play Division I sports? And we play Division I sports at Davidson because we believe playing sports at the highest level intercollegiate competition has educational value. It's over 25% of our students. There's only one door into Davidson, so everybody applies to Davidson. And I think there should be a place where kids who want to play D1 sports can also be pre-med. And that place is Davidson. And so I am deeply committed to the educational value of sports at that level and to being a place where our student athletes can study whatever they want and have the kind of life they want to have after they graduate.
Starting a football program is an ambitious sports and maybe fans. Risky thing. I don't know. We don't have to go back to the genesis of how that all began, but has it turned out to be what you and the students wanted it to be?
I'd like to quote the former president of the University of California, Clark Kerr, who said you had to do three things to be successful as a college president: ensure parking for the faculty and staff, sex and beer for the students, and a winning football team for the alumni. I'm leaving 2 out of 3. But
which one did you leave out?
No, we're not going to the Rose Bowl this year. But the point, we did it for very simple reasons. The students wanted it as part of their college experience. Our alumni wanted it as a reason to come back to the university, and we thought it would better connect us to the community. It has done all of those things, and it will do it better if we would start winning.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to dwell on this, but I was going to ask this in the radio part of this, because athletics is so much a part of college, a lot of college, and of the college experience, but sometimes it seems to get out of hand. I think college coaches, particularly at bigger schools that win a lot, are the highest paid. Well, are the coaches at Davidson the highest paid employees at Davidson? They are oftentimes the highest paid employees on a college campus. And that brings up this gentleman's question over here as well. And in the state of California, just passed a law that student athletes at public and private colleges and universities in that state will be allowed now to market and profit from their name, image, and likeness beginning in 2023. Is that good or bad for college athletics?
Well, I'm a member of the NCAA Division I board, so I'm going to demur on the question. But I think in particular...
But you're leaving, be honest.
Well, I've been a college president for 23 years. Why would I start that now? So, what I would say to you is I think there has to be some uniformity across the country in how that is handled, or the collegiate sports world will be pushed upside down. But the one thing about name, image, and likeness that we have to remember is there aren't that many students that would really have the kind of visibility to make that a commercial proposition. So I'll leave the rest of it to the courts.
Okay.
Well, I think it's an equity issue and an inequity, even at the Division I competitive level. There, as you highlighted, it's a small cadre of, you know, Power Five conference teams that are battling out what to do with these billions of dollars of revenue. And you know, candidly, there is an equity issue of how does that money get generated and what is equitable in terms of what to do with it. I love being at Queen's University of Charlotte, where I think we get it right for the same reasons that Dr. Quillen highlighted. Our students have a full and robust student athlete experience with our 24 Division II teams. They competed at a high level. We were fourth in the Learfield Cup standings of 312 Division II schools, and we were third in our academic achievement among those 312 schools. So we dial it in exactly right.
Go back here.
my name is Lainey. I'm a sophomore.
Put the microphone closer to your mouth. There
okay.
we go.
I'm a sophomore history major here. And earlier in the presentation, you had mentioned the declining enrollment in colleges and universities across the nation. And that really stuck out to me because as like a high school student and a college student, you really hear how it's getting more and more competitive. And why is that the case if enrollment is going down?
Great question.
Competitive in terms of admissions?
Yes.
I would say that that is another factor of what the media focuses on, right? So the media focuses on a particularly small group of colleges with hyper-selectivity. And that selectivity is influenced by many folks from not only around the country but around the world that want to go to those brands. But I think it's actually a much more diverse story. And the reality of population decline and what's going to happen over the next decade is not a perception. That is going to be real of how we're all going to survive and thrive with a smaller base of high school graduates and with definitely a disrupted marketplace of how we deliver a great education. So that's a real challenge. But selectivity, if you really look at the stories, you know, ask yourself who they're actually talking about. You know, what deans of admissions are they quoting? There are plenty of opportunities, and I think that we need to allow students to understand that. There are dozens of schools that will be a great fit for them that they can get into and that will support them launching into great lives of meaning.
Just a, may I ask her a question? How many schools did you apply to when you...
Eight.
So just in a very practical sense, and this says, you know, I think Dr. Lugo's answer was appropriate, but I think back to when I was applying to college when you actually had to type an application. And with a common application today, you know, students can hit a button and apply to like 20 schools in like 1 second. It would have taken me 24 days to apply to that many schools. And I think what the perception is that, or the reality is that there's so many more students applying to the same number of limited positions, because I think there are a lot more students who are applying to significantly more schools than they were years ago. And I think that's part of the answer. It's not the whole answer, but I think that's part of the answer.
For us, community colleges, when the economy is good and you're at full employment, our enrollment is always going to be down. We don't rest on those laurels. By the way, we would have taken you. You would have only had to have made one application. Open door, $76 a credit hour, and you would have saved so much money. And you could have transferred to any of one of these institutions and had all of your financial aid still available. And... if you would like to do that now, we would let you go to the 49er Next program at UNC Charlotte.
So now, how many of you are still requiring an SAT for admission?
Ooh, boy.
How many of you are still requiring an SAT for or an ACT for admission?
It's interesting you bring that. We just had, in my last management team meeting, I brought an article in for the senior management team to look at, and we're going to have a conversation about that. We actually have kind of a two admissions tracks. We have the regular admissions track. We also have an admissions track for what we call the metacognitive, non-cognitive admissions track, where we don't look at SAT scores. But in order to get in that track, you have to take it. But we are going to actually give some serious thought as to whether or not that's still required.
Is it not optional here at Queens?
It is optional. And we just made that policy a reality for this incoming application year. I've come from a number of schools that were test optional and believe deeply in it. This is not, standing against the College Board or the ACT folks, the kind folks out in Iowa. I think empowering students and families to put their best foot forward is really in the interest of the institutions as well as the families.
So when you remove that evaluation tool, what replaces it?
Well, so we have a holistic review in the admissions process. So we believe, and I think data somewhat bears it out, that what students do in terms of their choices and rigor in their curriculum is very, very informative of how they'll perform in a college experience. How they actually perform in that rigorous curriculum, incredibly important. What we hear from folks in referrals and teacher reviews, incredibly informative. And we have a holistic process that I think is very substantive and very, very data rich that allows our admissions team to find folks that will thrive here. Now, by the way, at any place that's gone test optional doesn't mean that all of a sudden folks don't continue to send SAT and ACT scores. It's just a choice. And in fact, most people still end up sending their scores. But in essence, it takes the pressure off. If the choice is, if your test scores aren't representative of what your four-year academic experience is, if what you did for 4 years is more important than what you did on a Saturday, we're willing to look at what you did for 4 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we have a strength-based. We have what we call a strengths-based evaluation tool that we use in a very limited number of instances. But looking at to the extent that we can broaden that and look at the strengths that a particular student brings and the qualities that they bring to an institution.
Malcolm Gladwell did a podcast on the LSAT. And he's from Canada, and they don't do standardized testing, and they don't do timed testing. And he was wondering what the value of making somebody to complete a module in the LSAT in X number of minutes was, because lawyers take their time to think through the law and their cases, and the very people that they're trying to get into law school are being told, you got to finish this in 10 minutes, or you're not getting in. So is there something comparable to that you can apply to the SAT in the same way?
It's a very good predictor of how you'll do on the next standardized test and of how many bathrooms there are in your house.
Let's go over here.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Queens is my beloved alma mater. And now I'm a writing tutor at CPCC. And it is not the first place where I've taught freshmen and sophomore students writing skills. My question to you is, and I hope this premise is wrong, but I've heard that the state legislature has gotten rid of funding for remedial classes for, I think, the next school year. And the need for remedial classes is great. I think every week I tell at least a couple students what a noun is and what a verb is and what a complete sentence is. One, is this what I've heard correct? And if so, what can you do to keep the remedial classes?
Okay, I'm assuming that question is for me. Probably. I have not heard that. What I have heard is, again, the community college system is going through a pilot phase about how we will teach remedial education. It's called the RISE program. It is in a pilot phase. I've been a huge advocate to remind folks of that. I think it is coming out of a conversation about how much funding is being applied to kind of retool individuals' skills as they come into community college system, but I've not heard that the funding is actually there. I think it is that's probably a natural conversation to come. But that conversation has been going on for many years. So I think we're re-looking at how we will do developmental education again, but I've not heard that as implicit as you implied.
Okay, back here.
Yes, my name is James Carruthers, and when I heard about the topic, I wanted to come out. I have association with pretty much all of the schools here. My mother was a 1955 graduate of Johnson C. Smith. I was an instructor at CPC. I graduated from Queens College with an MBA with Dr. Finley and Dr. DeBoris. I'm currently working with Dr. Silver and Dr. Kellevins and Dr. Webb on finishing, getting to a point where I can complete my DBA. Upcoming. So I preface that, say that to say that education has always been important to my family, and I see it being just not separate from the society that we live in, particularly here in Charlotte. I've been to two other Charlotte talks. One was about upward mobility. We were 50 out of 50 upward mobility, and then we had the talk at Friendship about the murder rate in Charlotte. So I think, see all of that being connected. And so my question is, how are you reaching out to particularly the Charlotte-Mecklenburg system in terms of preparing students on what they need to do to be successful? And I know part of the topic was about the cost of higher education, but as Dr. Du Bois said and some of the other panel, it's the value. The value is much more than what the cost is over the lifetime of someone who has the opportunity to go to school. So again, what are you doing with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg system to kind of tell them, you know, what they need to do to prepare the students to either come to the schools in the area or to other schools wherever they may choose to go?
Well, I think I got here maybe shortly after Dr. Dietemeyer, and when I got to Charlotte, the study had just come out, and as I sat, listened, talked to leaders around Charlotte, it became very, very apparent to me that this community really wanted to change that statistic, the 50 out of 50. And as I sat and thought about the position that Johnson C. Smith could play in that, I thought that there probably aren't many institutions in a better position to try to help that. So one of the initiatives that we're working on at Johnson C. Smith is something that I've affectionately dubbed the Pinnacle Scholars Program, in which it is looking at a kind of a more longitudinal process for students, trying to identify them as early as we can and get them college ready prior to coming to college, and then making sure that there are students that are local Charlotte TN students from CMS or whatever that have an opportunity to come to a place like John C. Smith or maybe some of these other institutions, but that money in and of itself will not be a barrier for them to be completed. So we are working on trying to develop that program. We're looking at working with some partners around town who do some of the work that we've talked about doing ourselves, which is this pre-college preparation, but most importantly, to make sure that if and when they come to Johnson C. Smith, they can come to and have their educations not interrupted because of funds. And then most importantly, to make sure that the education that we provide them, we fulfill that promise that I talked about earlier, and make sure that they're ready to go out into the world or into graduate school. So we are really, really focused on, and we're a small school, we're not gonna have hundreds of students, but we're gonna have hopefully tens and dozens of students who are local Charlatans who have an opportunity to get a great education and stay in Charlotte.
If I could, I think one of the things that we can do as institutions is try to figure out programs that will serve huge numbers of students, particularly in the way that you suggest, right? What is our role in helping high school age students get ready for college so that they will be successful once they get there? And there's a great program that started in North Carolina called the College Advising Corps, which places recent college grads from places like our institutions into underserved public high schools in the state. They do it nationwide, but particularly in North Carolina, where they serve as college counselors. These are schools they don't have the resources to have their own college counseling, and recent college grads can fill that role at no cost to the school. So, at Davidson, we have 20 advisors at any one time who are recent grads, and they serve hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students across the state of North Carolina. And they get those students to the school that will be best for them, wherever that school is. You know, financial aid, all of it. You know, here's what you have to do to get ready for this institution. Here's how you apply for financial aid. Here's where we think you should go. Here's how you can transfer from a community college to a four-year institution. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do beyond the students that we serve on our own campuses and at our own institutions.
Can I add to that a bit?
I think we have time for, I think, two more questions, and we're going back here first, Chris. Go ahead.
Good evening, my name is Clem. I'm an international studies major. And my question is, would you say that partnerships among institutions can help tackle the challenges of the affordability of higher education? Yes or no? And it may not necessarily or directly apply to the institution you're representing tonight, but if it does apply, how so? And if it doesn't, how do you think it can?
I didn't hear the second part of the question.
Yeah, we didn't hear the second part of the question.
So if that the first part of my question applied to the school or the institution representing tonight, how does that help in tackling the challenges of the affordability of higher education? And if it does not apply to the school you're representing, how do you think it can?
So maybe I could just give an example.
Okay.
Candy and I, 2 weeks ago, announced a program called 49er Next. And it was really aimed at students who wanted to go to the university but felt constrained by cost issues at the front end. So they make they get duly admitted to both institutions. They spend 2 full years at Central Piedmont with joint advisors, joint counseling on financial aid, joint advising on career. And I think our inaugural class is 113 students. That
111.
Are 111?
111.
Two dropped out. So.
No, it was always 111.
So we think that's a great example of a partnership that will work. These students get access to many UNC Charlotte amenities, our student union, light rail passes, going to the football games if they wish, when we're going to beat App State. So those kinds of things, I think, will make it possible to build in those students the culture of higher education from both institutions and then onto their degrees.
And to the gentleman's question earlier, we have to figure out as intentional partners how to scale that, mm-hmm. right? We already send 1,000. You start with 111 in an inaugural program that really had no advertisement, right? We did that internally. But as students learn about this, how do you scale that for more students, more opportunity? Because even though Phil is going to retire, I've committed that they will reach their 35,000 goal just because of Central Piedmont. So I may just say.
And one more right here.
Hello. I'm a mom of 3, so I have a 7th grader, a 9th grader, and an 11th grader. My 7th grader sent me a text when I told him where I was, and he said, please tell Mike Collins I want to meet him. I don't care when, I don't care where, no joke, he doesn't want to get out of the car until he hears the intro for your show.
Have you had him examined?
If you met him, you understand. You would understand. So my 2 high school students, I'm really trying to help them do what they're supposed to do, right? Get ready for life. And as a mom, I'm not certain how to help with laying the foundation for preparing them to understand what options are available. One definitely knows what she wants to do, and so she's going to intern with a surgeon in the OR to figure out, definitely before we spend the money and the time. One thought that's what he wanted to do. He interned. He decided that wasn't what he wanted, and so he's gone with everyone from the Knight Foundation to public servants to CEOs and everyone trying to figure it out. The problem I have is that I want to say, here, kids, here are the options. Here are different educational options. Here are different career paths that you can end up in. And in the meantime, I want you to be self-sufficient along the way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how to look at this community since I'm new to it and identify what resources are in this community that I can say, okay, let's go here and talk to these people. Let's go there and find out more about career pathways. Where do I go? Where do I help them with that? And as a member for North Carolina for STEM West, which is a public-private partnership for Western North Carolina, I recognize that employers don't really understand fully the buy-in of that organization and similar organizations where we help them to let high school students come in with their teachers, identify a problem, and then solve it with a solution. So then they are then understanding real world application for the advancement of where they're going to end up later, educationally and professionally.
Well, first of all, Mom, I just want to say, God bless you, right? I mean, first of all, I think asking the question, I think that that's the key, parents getting engaged or a guardian, someone in someone's life to make sure that they start thinking about what are all the choices. And I think you've heard that multitude of ways tonight. So each one of our websites, there's going to be career landing spots. It's going to be able to articulate the why, the job, the outcome of that. But I would say it's about fit and feel as well. You know, I talked earlier, what brings you joy, what's your passion? I would bring your kids to each one of the campuses up here if they want to stay in Charlotte. There's lots of other colleges, certainly throughout the state and in the country. But each one of our institutions has a different fit and a different feel. And different things that they should just come and see. I tell folks all the time, especially parents, if you will just come, you have to land. You spend more time thinking about a car you want to buy and a house you want to buy. You get in the car, you try it out, you see if you like the way the windows, you know, you go to a house, does it have all the rooms you want? You need to do the same thing, an informed decision about the college of choice that you want for your kids. Come try, kick the tires, take a tour, talk to people on campus, see other students, and get the information. And then just, I would say just let them, I mean, that's going to be more than most people do, to be honest. And then don't fill out the 8 applications. You're going to find the right fit for them just because you're doing it, you're asking good questions from the front end.
50% of the students who come into UNC Charlotte as freshmen have no declared major. And what I would say to you is allow room for exploration, that's maturation, right, and serendipity. You don't need to box them in when they're 15. They'll be fine. That's the hardest thing for parents to hear at UNC Charlotte when we talk with them. They worry about, well, they got to pick something. They'll figure it out. They'll figure it out.
And they're going to come to those campuses and see things that they don't even know are career options because they're cool or they didn't know. No one talked to them about. But unless you come and actually let them experience that, and they may choose something and change their major, we do that all the time as well.
So I think there's also an important point that all of the advice is spot on, but actually training our young people to welcome that kind of ambiguity is actually really important in this kind of modern world. Things are changing so quickly. I think you have obviously some really brilliant kids, especially if your youngest knows who Mike Collins is, right? This is impressive. I know he's really famous, but you're youngest. I think actually creating an environment, it's always been good advice to stay open, but now more than ever, it's going to be impossible to predict what the fields of need and what's going to be available. I mean, just think about what we've experienced in the last 20 years. And think about the culture of discovery that's happening around the world and what that world's going to look like in their lives. So, exactly. Keeping them open is actually not only good advice, it's strategically important right now.
And it's hard to imagine what that world is going to look like in their world. So, and be broad and open to all possibilities is really a key.
And since you have 3 children all going to college, it seems to me, let them take their time figuring out what they want to do and what major they want to be. By the 6th or 7th year in college, there's still student aid available. I think that wraps it up. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.